hospital. The lavatory's been locked for 3 hours solid. I think they're using it for an operating room. Nurse, I can't find her pulse, doctor. Dr. Banway, maybe she's got it up her cunt in the finger still. Nurse, adrenaline doctor? Dr. Banway, the night porter shut it all up for kicks. He looks around and picks up one of those rubber vacuum cups at the end of a stick they use to unstop toilets. He advances on the patient. Make an incision, Dr. Limpy says to his appalled assistant. I'm going to massage the heart. Dr. Limp shrugs and begins the incision. Dr. Benway washes the suction cup by swishing it around in the toilet bowl. Nurse, shouldn't it be sterilized, doctor? Dr. Benway, very likely, but there's no time. He sits on the suction cup like a cane seat, watching his assistant make the incision. You young squirts couldn't lance a pimple without an electric vibrating scalpel with automatic drain and suture. So we'll be operating by remote control on patients we never see. We'll be nothing but button pushers. All the skill is going out of surgery. All the know-how and make-do. Did I ever tell you about the time I performed an appendectomy with a rusty sardine can? And once I was caught short without instrument one and removed an uterine tumor with my teeth. That was in the upper fendi, and besides, the wench is dead. Dr. Limp, the incision is ready, doctor. Dr. Benway forces the cup into the incision and works it up and down. Blood spurts all over the doctors, the nurse, and the wall. The cup makes a horrible sucking sound. Nurse, I think she's gone, doctor. Dr. Benway, well, it's on a day's work. He walks across the room to a medicine cabinet. Some fucking drug addict has cut my cocaine with Sani Flush. Nurse, send the boy out to fill this RX on the double. Dr. Benway is operating in an auditorium filled with students. Now, boys, you won't see this operation performed very often. There's a reason for that. You see, it has absolutely no medical value. No one knows what the purpose of it originally was, or if it had a purpose at all. Personally, I think it was a pure artistic creation from the beginning. Just as a bullfighter, with his skill and knowledge, extricates himself from danger he has himself invoked, so in this operation, the surgeon deliberately endangers his patient, and then, with incredible speed and celerity, rescues him from death at the last possible split second. Did any of you ever see Dr. Tepezzini perform? I say perform advisedly, because his operations were performances. He would start by throwing a scalpel across the room into the patient, and then make his entrance like a ballet dancer. His speed was incredible. I don't give them time to die, he would say. Tumors put him in a frenzy of rage. Fucking undisciplined cells, he would snarl, advancing on the tumor like a knife fighter. A young man leaps down into the operating theater and, whipping out a scalpel, advances on the patient. Dr. Benway, and Espontaneo, stop him before he guts my patient. Dawson's Rumpus Room. A Near East Mugwump sits naked on a bar stool covered in pink silk. He licks warm honey from a crystal goblet with a long black tongue. His genitals are perfectly formed. Circumcised cock, black, shiny pubic hairs. His lips are thin and purple-blue like the lips of a penis. His eyes blank with insect calm. The mugwump has no liver, maintaining himself exclusive on sweets. Mugwump pushed a slender blonde youth to a couch and stripped him expertly. Stand up and turn around, he orders in telepathic pictographs. He ties the boy's hands behind him with a red silk cord. Tonight we make it all the way. No, no, screams the boy. Yes, yes. Cocks ejaculate in silent yes. Mugwump part silk curtains, reveal a teakwood gallows against lighted screen of red flint. Gallows is on a dais of Aztec mosaics. The boy crumples to his knees with a long oh, shitting and pissing in terror. He feels the shit warm between his thighs. A great wave of hot blood swells his lips and throat. His body contracts into a fetal position and sperm spurts hot into his face. The mugwump dips hot perfumed water from an alabaster bowl, pensively washes the boy's ass and cock, drying him with a soft blue towel. A warm wind plays over the boy's body and the hairs float free. The mugwump puts a hand under the boy's chest and pulls him to his feet, holding him by both pinioned elbows, propels him up the steps and under the noose. He stands in front of the boy, holding the noose in both hands. The boy looks into mugwump eyes blank as obsidian mirrors, pools of black blood, glory holes in a toilet wall closing on the last erection. The mugwump slips the noose over the boy's head and tightens the knot caressingly behind the left ear. The boy's penis is retracted, his balls tight. He looks straight ahead, breathing deeply. The mugwump sidles around the boy, goosing him and caressing his genitals in hieroglyphs of mockery. He moves in behind the boy with a series of bumps and shoves his cock up the boy's ass. He stands there, moving in circular gyrations. The guests shush each other, nudge and giggle. Suddenly, the mugwump pushes the boy forward into space, free of his cock. He studies the boy with hands on the hip bones, reaches up with his stylized hieroglyph hands, and snaps the boy's neck. A shudder passes through the boy's body. His penis rises in three great surges, pulling his pelvis up, ejaculates immediately. Green sparks explode behind his eyes. A sweet toothache pain shoots through his neck down the spine to the groin, contracting the body in spasms of delight. His whole body squeezes out through his cock. A final spasm throws a great spurt of sperm across the red screen, like a shooting star. The boy falls with soft, gutty suction through a maze of penny arcades and dirty pictures. A sharp turd shoots clean out his ass. Farts shake his slender body. Skyrockets burst in green clusters across a great river. He hears the faint putt-putt of a motorboat in jungle twilight under silent wings of the anopheles mosquito. The mugwump pulls the boy back onto his cock. The boy squirms, impaled like a speared fish. The mugwump swings on the boy's back, his body contracting in fluid waves. Blood flows down the boy's chin from his mouth, half open, sweet and sulky in death. The mugwump falls with a fluid sated plop. Windowless cubicle with blue walls. Dirty pink curtain covers the door. Bed bugs crawl on the wall, cluster in corners. A man with white tie and dress shirt, naked from the waist down except for black garters, talks to the queen bee in elegant tones. Queen bees are old women who surround themselves with fairies to form a swarm. It is a sinister Mexican practice. But where is the statuary? He talks out of one side of his face. The other is twisted by the torture of a million mirrors. He masturbates wildly. The queen bee continues the conversation, notices nothing. A horde of lust-mad American women rush in. Dripping cunts from farm and dude ranch, factory, brothel, country club, penthouse and suburb, motel and yacht and cocktail bar, strip-off riding clothes, ski togs, evening dresses, Levi's, tea gowns, print dresses, slacks, bathing suits and kimonos. They scream and yipe and howl. Leap on the guests like bitch dogs in heat with rabies. They claw at the hang boys, shrieking, "You fairy, you bastard, fuck me, fuck me, fuck me!" The guests flee screaming, dodge among the hang boys, overturn iron lungs. AJ's annual party. Mary is strapping on a rubber penis. Steely Dan 3 from Yokohama, she says, caressing the shaft. Milk spurts across the room. Be sure that milk is pasteurized. Don't go giving me some kind of awful cow disease like anthrax or glanders or aftosa. When I was a transvestite, lives in Shy, used to work as an exterminator, make advances to pretty boys for the thrill of being beaten as a man. Later, I catch this one kid, overpower him with supersonic judo I learned from an old lesbian Zen monk. I tie him up, strip off his clothes with a razor, and fuck him with Steely Dan 1. He is so relieved I don't castrate him literal. He comes all over my bedbug spray. What happened to Steely Dan 1? He was torn in two by a bull dyke. Most terrific vaginal grip I ever experienced. She could cave in a lead pipe. It was one of her parlor tricks. And Steely Dan 2? Chewed to bits by a famished kangaroo in the upper baboon's asshole. And don't say we this time. Why not? It's real boyish. The rising sun fills the room with pink light. Johnny is let in, hands tied between Mary and Mark. Johnny sees the gallows and sighs with a great oh, his chin pulling down towards his cock, his legs bending at the knees. Sperm spurts arching almost vertical in front of his face. Mark and Mary are suddenly impatient and hot. They push Johnny forward onto the gallows platform, covered with moldy jockstraps and sweatshirts. Mark is adjusting the noose. Well, here you go. Mark starts to push Johnny off the platform. Mary, no, let me. She locks her hands behind Johnny's buttocks, puts her forehead against him. Smiling into his eyes, she moves back, pulling him off the platform into space. His face swells with blood. Mark reaches up with one lithe movement and snaps Johnny's neck. Sound like a stick broken in wet towels. A shudder runs down Johnny's body. One foot flutters like a trapped bird. Mark has draped himself over a swing and mimics Johnny's twitches, closes his eyes and sticks his tongue out. Johnny's cock springs up and Mary guides it up her cunt, writhing against him in a fluid belly dance, groaning and shrieking with delight. Sweat pours down her body. Hair hangs over her face in wet strands. "Cut him down, Mark," she screams. Mark reaches over with a snap knife and cuts the rope, catching Johnny as he falls, easing him onto his back with Mary still impaled and writhing. She bites away Johnny's lips and nose and sucks out his eyes with a pop. She tears off great hunks of cheek. Now she lunges on his prick. Mark walks over to her, and she looks up from Johnny's half-eaten genitals, her face covered with blood, eyes phosphorescent. Mark puts his foot on her shoulder and kicks her over on her back. He leaps on her, fucking her insanely. They roll from one end of the room to the other, pinwheel end over end, and leap high in the air like a great hooked fish. "Let me hang you, Mark. Let me hang you. Please, Mark, let me hang you." "Sure, baby." He pulls her brutally to her feet and pins her hands behind her. "No, Mark, no, no, no," she screams, shitting and pissing in terror as he drags her to the platform. Meeting of International Conference of Technological Psychiatry. Dr. Finger Schaefer, the lobotomy kid, rises and turns on the conference the cold blue blast of his gaze. "Gentlemen, the human nervous system can be reduced to a compact and abbreviated spinal column. The brain, front, middle, and rear, must follow the adenoid, the wisdom tooth, the appendix. I give you my masterwork, the complete all-American de-anxietized man. Blast of trumpets. The man is carried in naked by two Negro bearers who drop him on the platform with bestial sneering brutality. The man wriggles. His flesh turns to viscid, transparent jelly that drifts away in green mist, unveiling a monster black centipede. Waves of unknown stench fill the room, searing the lungs, grabbing the stomach. "Man, he done seen the light," said one of the Negro bearers. "We must stomp out the un-American critter," says a fat, frog-faced southern doctor who's been drinking corn out of a mason jar. He advances drunkenly and then halts, appalled by the formidable size and menacing aspect of the centipede. "Fetch gasoline, bellies. We gotta burn the son of a bitch like an uppity nigger." The centipede is rushing about in agitation. "Man, that motherfucker's hungry," screams one of the bearers. "I'm getting out of here, me." A wave of electric horror sweeps through the conference. They storm the exits, screaming and clawing. The market. Panorama of the city of Interzone. composite city where all human potentials are spread out in a vast silent market. Minarets, palms, mountains, jungle, a sluggish river jumping with vicious fish. Vast weed-grown parks where boys lie in the grass, play cryptic games. Not a locked door in the city. Anyone comes into your room at any time. The chief of police is a Chinese who picks his teeth and listens to denunciations presented by a lunatic. Every now and then, the Chinese takes the toothpick out of his mouth and looks at the end of it. Hipsters with smooth, copper-colored faces lounge in doorways, twisting shrunk heads on gold chains, their faces blank with an insect's unseeing calm. All houses in the city are joined, houses of sod. High mountain Mongols blink in smoky doorways. Houses of bamboo and teak, houses of adobe, stone, and red brick. South Pacific and Maori houses. Houses and trees and riverboats. Woodhouses 100 feet long, sheltering entire tribes. Houses of boxes and corrugated iron, where old men sit in rotten rags, cooking down canned heat. Great rusty iron racks rising 200 feet in the air from swamps and rubbish, with perilous partitions built on multi-level platforms and hammocks swinging over the void. The city is visited by epidemics of violence, and the untended dead are eaten by vultures in the streets. Albinos blink in the sun. Boys sit in trees, languidly masturbate. People eaten by unknown diseases watch the passerby with evil, knowing eyes. In the city market is the meat cafe. Followers of obsolete, unthinkable trades doodling in Etruscan. Addicts of drugs not yet synthesized. Pushers of souped-up harmalin. Junk reduced to pure habit, offering precarious vegetable serenity. Liquids to induce latte, Tithonian longevity serums, black marketeers of World War III, excisers of telepathic sensitivity, osteopaths of the spirit, investigators of infractions denounced by bland, paranoid chess players, servers of fragmentary warrants taken down in habophrenic shorthand, charging unspeakable mutilations of the spirit. Bureaucrats of spectral departments. Officials of unconstituted police states. A lesbian dwarf who has perfected Operation Bangu Tot. The lung erection that strangles a sleeping enemy. Sellers of Oregon tanks and relaxing machines. Brokers of exquisite dreams and memories, tested on the sensitized cells of junk sickness and bartered for raw materials of the will. Doctors skilled in the treatment of diseases dormant in the black dust of ruined cities, gathering virulence in the white blood of eyeless worms, feeling slowly to the surface in the human host. Maladies of the ocean floor and the stratosphere. Maladies of the laboratory in atomic war. A place where the unknown past and the emergent future meet in a vibrating, soundless hum. Larval entities waiting for a live one. A funeral passes through the market. Black coffin, Arabic inscriptions in filigreed silver. Carried by 4 pallbearers. Procession of mourners singing the funeral song. Clem and Jody fall in beside them, carrying coffin. The corpse of a hog bursts out of it. The hog is dressed in a jalaba. A keef pipe juts from its mouth. One hoof holds a packet of feezy pictures. A mezuzah hangs about its neck. Inscribed on the coffin, this was the noblest Arab of them all. They sing hideous parody of the funeral song in false Arabic. Jody can do a fake Chinese spiel that'll just kid you. like a hysterical ventriloquist dummy. In fact, he precipitated an anti-foreign riot in Shanghai that claimed 3,000 casualties. Stand up, Gertie, and show respect for the local gooks. I suppose one should. My dear, I'm working on the most marvelous invention. A boy who disappears as soon as you come, leaving a smell of burning leaves and a sound effect of distant train whistles. This you gotta hear. Boy in Los Angeles, 15-year-old. Father decided it's time the boy have his first piece of ass. Boy's lying on the lawn reading comic books. Father go out and say, "Son, here's $20. I want you to go to a good whore and get a piece of ass off her." So they drive to this plush jump joint. And the father say, "All right, son, you're on your own. So ring the bell, and when the woman come, give her the $20 and tell her you want a piece of ass. Sell it, Bob." So about 15 minutes later, the boy comes out. "Well, son, did you get a piece of ass?" "Yeah. This gash comes to the door, and I say I want a piece of ass, and lay the double sauce on her. We go up to her trap, and she removed her dry goods. So I switch my blade and cut a big hunk off her ass. She raise up beef like I am reduced to pull off one shoe and beat her brains up. Then I hop her for kicks." Another installment in the adventures of Clem Snide, the private asshole. So I walk in the joint and this female hustler sits at the bar. And I think, "Oh, God, you're pulled to looks already. I mean, it's like I see the gash before." So I don't pay her no mind at first. Then I dig she is rubbing her legs together and working her feet up behind her head. Shoves it down to give herself a douche job with a gadget sticks out of her nose, the way a body can't help but notice. Iris, half Chinese and half Negro, addicted to dehydroxyheroin. Takes a shot every 15 minutes. To which end she leaves droppers and needles sticking out all over her. The needles rust in her dry flesh, which here and there has grown completely over her joint to form a smooth green-brown wen. On the table in front of her is a samovar of tea and a 20-pound hamper of brown sugar. No one has ever seen her eat anything else. It is only just before a shot that she hears what anyone says or talks herself. Then she makes some flat, factual statement relative to her own person. "My asshole is occluding. My cunt got terrible green juices." Iris is one of Benway's projects. The human body can run on sugar alone, goddammit. I'm aware that certain of my learned colleagues who are tempted to belittle my genius work claim that I put vitamins and proteins into Iris's sugar clandestinely. I challenge these nameless assholes to crawl up out of their latrines and run a spot analysis on Iris's sugar and her tea. Iris is a wholesome American cunt. I deny categorically that she nourishes herself on semen. And let me take this opportunity to state that I am a reputable scientist, not a charlatan, a lunatic, or a pretended worker of miracles. I never claimed that Iris could subsist exclusively on photosynthesis. I did not say she could breathe in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. I confess I have been tempted to experiment, being, of course, restrained by my medical ethics. In short, the vile slanders of my creeping opponents will inevitably fall back onto them and come to roost like a homing stool pigeon. Thank you. ordinary men and women. So this elegant faggot comes to New York from Conflict, Texas, and he is the most piss-elegant fag of them all. He is taken up by old women of the type batting on young fags. Toothless old predators, too weak and too slow to run down other prey. As his old moth-eaten tigress shit sure turn into a fag-eater. So this citizen, being an arty and crafty fag, begins making costume jewelry and jewelry sets. Every rich old gash in greater New York wants she should do her sets, and he is making money. You know, 21, El Morocco, the stork, but no time for sex and all the time worrying about his rep. He begins playing the horses. Supposed to be something manly about gambling, God knows why. And he figures it will build him up to be seen at the track. Now, not many fags play the horses, and those that play lose more than the others. They're lousy gamblers, plunge in a losing streak, and hedge when they win, which being the pattern of their lives. So he loses and loses and loses some more. One day he's about to put a rock in a set when the obvious occurs. Of course, I'll replace it later. Famous last words. So all that winter, one after the other, the diamonds, emeralds, pearls, rubies and stars, sapphires of the haute monde, go in hock, replaced by queer replicas. So the opening night of the Met, this old hag appears as she thinks resplendent in her diamond tiara. This other old whore approach and say, "Oh, Miggles, you're so smart. To leave the real ones at home, I mean, we're simply mad to go around tempting fate. You're mistaken, my dear. These are real." "Oh, but Miggles, darling, they're not. I mean, ask your jeweler." "Well, just ask anybody." Ah! So Sabbath is hastily called. Lucy Bradshinkle, look to thy emeralds. All these old witches examining their rocks like a citizen find leprosy on himself. "My chicken bun ruby, my black opals. Old bitch Mary so many times, so many gooks and spicks she don't know her accent from her ass. My star sapphire, shake a pool deluxe. Oh, it's all so awful. I mean, they're strictly from Walworth's. There's only one thing to do. I'm going to call the police," says a strong-minded, outspoken old thing, and she clomps across the floor on her low heels and calls the fuzz. Well, the faggot draws a deuce, and in the box he meets this cat who is some species of cheap hustler, and love sets in, or at least a facsimile thereof, convinced the parties in the first and second parts. As continuity would have it, they are sprung at the same time, more or less, and take up residence in a flat on the Lower East Side, and cook in, and both are working legit, modest jobs. So Brad and Jim know happiness for the first time. Enter the powers of evil. Lucy Bradshinkle has come to say all is forgiven. She has faith in Brad and wants to set him up in a studio. Of course, he will have to move to the East 60s. This place is impossible, darling. And your friend. And a safe mob wants Jim back to drive a car. This is a step up, you dig. Offer from citizens hardly see him before. Will Jim go back to crime? Will Brad succumb to the blandishments of an aging vampire or ravening maw? Needless to say, the forces of evil are routed and exit with ominous snarls and mutterings. The boss isn't gonna like this. "I don't know why I ever wasted my time with you, you cheap, vulgar little fairy." The boys stand at the tenement window, their arms around each other, looking at the Brooklyn Bridge. A warm spring wind ruffles Jim's black curls and the fine henned hair of Brad. Well, Brad, what's for supper?
You just go in the other room and wait.
Playfully, he shoos Jim out of the kitchen and puts on his apron. Dinner is Lucy Bradshinkle's Comte Seigneur, cooked in Codex Papillon. The boys eat happily, looking into each other's eyes. Blood runs down their chins. Did I ever tell you about the man who taught his asshole to talk? His whole abdomen would move up and down, you dig, farting out the words. It was unlike anything I ever heard. This ass-talk had a sort of gut frequency. It hit you right down there like you gotta go. You know when the old colon gives you the elbow and you feel sort of cold inside and you know all you have to do is turn loose? Well, this talking hits you right down there, a bubbly, thick, stagnant sound, a sound you could smell. This man worked for a carnival, you dig, and to start with, it was like a novelty ventriloquist act. Real funny, too, at first. He had a number he called a better old. It was a scream, I tell you. I forget most of it, but it was clever. Like, oh, say, are you still down there, old thing? No, I had to go relieve myself. After a while, the ass started talking on its own. He would go in without anything prepared, and his ass would ad-lib and toss the gags back at him every time. Then it developed sort of teeth like little raspy incurving hooks and started eating. He thought this was cute at first and built an act around it, but the asshole would eat its way through his pants and start talking on the street, shouting out it wanted equal rights. Yeah, they would get drunk, too, and have crying jags. Nobody loved it, and they wanted to be kissed same as any other mouth. Finally, it talked all the time, day and night. You could hear him for blocks, screaming at it to shut up, and beating it with his fists, and sticking candles up it. But nothing did any good. And the asshole said to him, "It's you who will shut up in the end, not me. Because we don't need you around here anymore. I can talk and eat and shit." After that, he began waking up in the morning with a transparent jelly like a tadpole's tail all over his mouth. This jelly was what the scientists call UDT. Undifferentiated tissue, which can grow into any kind of flesh on the human body. He would tear it off his mouth, and the pieces would stick to his hands like burning gasoline jelly and grow there. Grow anywhere on him, a glob of it fell. So finally his mouth sealed over and the whole head would have amputated spontaneously. Did you know that this condition occurs in parts of Africa and only among Negroes where the little toe amputates spontaneously? Except for the eyes, you dig. That's one thing the asshole couldn't do was see. It needed the eyes. But nerve connections were blocked and infiltrated and atrophied so the brain couldn't give orders anymore. It was trapped in the skull, sealed off. For while you could see the silent, helpless suffering of the brain behind the eyes, then finally the brain must have died, because the eyes went out, and there was no more feeling in them than a crab's eye on the end of a stalk. The huntsmen have gathered for the hunt breakfast in the swarm bar. They hang out for elegant pansies. The huntsmen strut about with imbecile narcissism in black leather jackets and studded belts, flexing their muscles for the fags to feel. They all wear enormous falsy baskets. Every now and then one of them throws a fag to the floor and pisses on him. They are drinking victory punch, compounded of paregoric, Spanish fly, heavy black rum, Napoleon brandy in canned heat. The punch is served from a great hollow gold baboon, crouched in snarling terror, snapping at a spear in its side. You twist the baboon's balls and the punch runs out his cock. From time to time, hot hors d'oeuvres pop out the baboon's ass with a loud farting noise. When this happens, the huntsmen roar with bestial laughter, and the fags shriek and twitch. Master of the hunt is Captain Everard, who was drummed out of the Queen's 69th for palming a jockstrap in a game of strip poker. Motorcycles careening, jumping, overturning, spitting, shrieking, shitting baboons, fighting hand to hand with the huntsmen, riderless cycles scrabbling about in the dust like crippled insects, attacking baboon and huntsman. The party leader rides in triumph through yipping crowds. A dignified old man shits at sight of him and tries to sacrifice himself under the wheels of the car. "They have no feelings," said Dr. Benway, slashing his patient to shreds. "Just reflexes. I urge distraction. The age of consent is when they learn to talk. May all your troubles be little ones, as one child molester said to the other." The market is empty, except for an old drunkard of indeterminate nationality, passed out with his head in a peace war. The rioters erupt into the market, yipping and screaming, "Death to the French!" and tear the drunkard to pieces. A whimpering queen falls to the floor in an orgasm. "Oh, God, it's too exciting, like a million hot-throbbing cocks!" Benway, like to run a blood test on those boys. A portentously inconspicuous man, gray beard and gray face and shabby brown jalaba, sings in a slight unplaceable accent without opening his lips. "Oh, you dolls, you great big beautiful dolls." Squads of police with thin lips, big noses and cold gray eyes move into the market from every entrance street. They club and kick the rioters with cold, methodical brutality. The rioters have been carted away in trucks. The shutters go up and the citizens of Interzone step out into the square, littered with teeth and sandals and slippery with blood.